funding for Think comes from SMU's Master of Liberal Studies.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. How strong is 21st century Pakistan? And are reports that it is in danger of becoming a failed state simply exaggerated? My guest today is convinced that Pakistan's well-being has far greater implications for global peace and stability than almost anything that might happen in Afghanistan. But he is also convinced that despite its many serious problems, the strength of Pakistani society lends support to the republic as a whole. Anatol Levin is professor of international relations and terrorism studies in the War Studies Department of King's College in London. He's also a senior fellow at the New America Foundation and author of the new book, Pakistan, A Hard Country. Anatol, welcome to Think.
Thank you so much.
Why is the welfare of Pakistan more critical to global security than Afghanistan?
Well, as I always say, it's a matter of mathematics rather than sentiment. Pakistan has almost 200 million people. That's six times the population of Afghanistan. As a Brit, I'm particularly sensitive to the threat in Pakistan because, like Canada, we have a huge diaspora from there, which is very closely linked back to its towns and villages in Pakistan. And then, of course, you have the issue of Pakistan's nuclear weapons, which, if they fell into the hands of terrorists, would pose, a really apocalyptic threat to the West. But even before that, if the Pakistani army were to disintegrate, it's an army of 500,000 men. It has huge stocks of munitions, anti-aircraft missiles, tens of thousands of trained engineers, and so forth. That would raise the terrorist threat to the West also by an order of magnitude, at least. And these are far greater threats, in my view, than anything that Afghanistan can generate.
So why do so many observers see the country as on the brink of collapse, and what do they miss in terms of the factors that help keep it going?
Well, at first sight, God knows, there are enough reasons to see Pakistan as collapsing. There's an insurgency by the Pakistani Taliban, which controls large parts of the tribal areas. There's been a huge increase in terrorism by the Islamist extremists in recent years. There have been high-level assassinations, including of Benazir Bhutto, the then leader of the opposition, and earlier this year of Salman Taseer, the governor of Punjab. There are serious ethnic problems in several parts of the country. There are divisions between the different provinces, and so forth and so on. On the other hand, I was out in Pakistan last month, and I went up to an area called Swat, which was previously controlled by the Pakistani Taliban. And the army has defeated them, driven them out. It's done the same in other areas. In Swat, I was very impressed by how reconstruction is going, despite the fact that they have to reconstruct not just after the fighting there, but after the terrible floods last year. And the Pakistan army, I think, has now shown that it can defeat the insurgents, though not terrorism. Terrorism, is, I'm afraid, with Pakistan now for the foreseeable future. Mm-hmm. And on the political side, Pakistan is ruled by these clans, political clans led by property-owning chieftains whose influence extends deep into society. And by their very nature, they're opposed to an Islamist revolution that would destroy their power and wealth. On the other hand, it must be said that these clans are also a key part of the problem, or the reason why, although I think Pakistan will survive, I doubt that it will progress very far or very fast.
Let's talk about the difference between the Pakistani Taliban and the Afghan Taliban, which many people are aware sort of will rest up and recuperate within the borders of Pakistan. And there are very different sentiments even among average Pakistanis about how the two groups should be handled.
That's it. I'm very sorry to say, and believe me, I don't like saying this at all, but the feelings of the vast majority of Pakistanis with whom I've spoken about the Afghan Taliban are very close to their feelings about the Afghan Mujahideen, who were fighting the Soviets in the 1980s in Afghanistan. And I was a journalist then, and I accompanied them on a number of occasions. The Pakistanis, on the whole, see them, not as nice people or people they would wish to see ruling Pakistan. But I'm afraid that they do see them as a legitimate resistance force who have a right to fight in their own country against what is seen as an alien occupation of that country. So the Afghan Taliban do have a lot of sympathy in Pakistan. And the Pakistani Taliban initially also drew sympathy from the fact that they were seen as allies of the Afghan Taliban, simply defending the Afghan Taliban against what was called the slave government of General Musharraf, slaves, of course, to the United States. Now, I'm happy to say that that feeling in Pakistan has gone down in recent years, both because of the savagery of the Pakistani Taliban towards fellow Pakistanis, and because it's become quite clear that they're not just aiming to defend the Afghan Taliban, that they are also aiming at power within Pakistan, and most Pakistanis don't want that.
So in the modern history of Pakistan's government, it has sort of volleyed back and forth between civilian and military control. What is the lasting impact of all that constant change?
The impact of the endless changes has been to worsen the governance and progress in Pakistan. Every government that comes in has had a terrible tendency to tear up all the plans of the government that came before, partly in order to make new plans and then distribute the resulting patronage to their followers. However, a thesis of my book is that when it comes to the lives of ordinary Pakistanis, and actually when it comes to the development of the country, at least since the 1960s or 70s, there's been much less difference between military and civilian governments than appears at first sight. And the key reason is that in Pakistan, the state, whoever is running it, is very weak. And these property-owning clans led by the so-called feudals and local networks of religious allegiance and ethnic and tribal allegiance are so strong that most of the time, or a lot of the time, they can frustrate whatever the state wants to do. That's clearest of all when it comes to tax collection. Pakistan collects less than 10% of its GDP in taxes. That's the lowest in South Asia. India collects 17%. The reason for that is that the wealthy in Pakistan are strong enough not to pay tax. So the state just doesn't have the money to spend on services, on infrastructure, on education, and so on.
So they may only take care of their own, these tribal affiliations and sort of regional power structures, but they do, in fact, take care of their own?
Well, to a sharply diminishing degree, go down in society. Obviously the chieftains keep a lot for themselves. They distribute the rest to their immediate followers and so forth and so on. But yes, quite a lot of the population does get something out of this system. I mean, not nearly what they'd get, of course, if Pakistan could really develop, you know, economically and socially, but enough a lot of the time to keep them basically quiescent and loyal. And of course, if the alternative is an Islamist revolution that would destroy Pakistan and would increase the terrorist threats to us colossally, then I suppose, on balance, it's a good thing. Although I have to say that even some educated Pakistanis think that the present situation is so bad that even a general collapse would be better. I think they're wrong. I mean, I've been in countries that have really collapsed, like Afghanistan, in the past. I wouldn't like to see that happen in Pakistan.
So the president and prime minister are indirectly elected. How much power do civilian voters really exercise?
The voters exercise very little. The elites exercise a huge amount. And the voter has a certain amount of maneuver, though, because, you know, even in these clans of which I've spoken, there are very often rival leaders. So if one doesn't give you what you want, you can vote for the other, who may give you a little bit more. But I have to say that the general opinion of ordinary Pakistanis is that they never get most of what they want from the politicians.
Now, Pakistani women have had the right to vote in national elections since 1956. These days, 18% of parliament seats are reserved for female lawmakers. But as recently as 2008, we were hearing about women being discouraged in certain villages from exercising their right to vote. What is the state of women's lives in Pakistan today?
At the elite level, but I mean the top elite level, you have women politicians like, indeed, the late Benazir Bhutto, who was prime minister, You have women diplomats, including two former ambassadors to the United States. The last head of the Pakistani State Bank was a woman. So at that level, women do play a considerable role. In most of society, and particularly in the countryside, their position is very downtrodden indeed. They are, when they step out of line, sometimes subjected to the most savage punishments. I'm extremely sorry to say that only a couple of days ago, the gang rapist in this famous case of Mukhtar Amai, which happened 10 years ago now almost, were acquitted by the Supreme Court. This was a rape which was ordered as a punishment by a local council. So there is an extraordinary contrast between the lives of the top elites in that regard and the lives of most of society, particularly in the tribal areas of the country.
My guest this hour is Anatol Levin. He is Professor of International Relations and Terrorism Studies at King's College in London and a senior fellow at the New America Foundation. His new book is called Pakistan, A Hard Country. If you'd like to join the conversation, you can get online at think@kera.org. Send an email. In a few more minutes, you will also be able to call in to our regular number. But for right now, send us an email and we will process your question that way. Jeff Whittington joins me now. Good afternoon, Jeff.
Hey, Chris. It is the first day of the spring membership campaign here at KERA. We'd like to offer you your very own copy of Anatol Levin's new book, Pakistan, A Hard Country. It's actually very well received out there in the publishing world, and you may have already seen it. You may have already heard of it. Well, we can offer it to you today with our thanks when you join the station at the $120 membership level. That's just $10 a month when you become a sustaining member of the station, and we will really appreciate the fact that you're supporting your public radio station during this membership campaign, during the first day of the membership campaign. And we'll show that appreciation, of course, by sending you your copy of the book.
We know that so many of you are voracious readers and sort of run out when you hear something that interests you on this program and get a copy of the book. We also know some of you think, well, I don't have time to read the book, but I love hearing this hour of conversation. And of course, it's not always about a book, but we like to think that we provide to you the equivalent of a really lengthy, maybe newspaper article or something. And in this case, we're speaking with the author of those articles. We try very hard, Jeff and I, to bring you people who are at the top of their game, not just in this country, but in the world in terms of understanding the topics we discuss. We're really proud to be able to bring it to you. It's all possible because you step up and send your contributions to 1-888-694-6931. And you go online. We like that even better because it's quick and easy, to kera.org and make contributions there.
There is a drawing for an iPad 2 every day for the first 9 days of this membership campaign. Once you enter, you're in the drawing for each day, so the sooner you get your name in, the better your chances will be. That's a pretty great deal. Just call 888-694-6931 or go online to kera.org, make your contribution, and we'll enter you into that drawing.
Your support of this station allows us to continue bringing you guests like Anatol Levin, like all the other people that you hear day in and day out. We love to hear from you. Sometimes you hear from us and tell us you love something. Sometimes you hear from us and make a correction. We heard from somebody last week. I misspoke and said that Buckminster Fuller was from Dallas. He wasn't. And a sharp listener said, you're incorrect about that. The deal is that the Buckminster Fullerene is the official state molecule of Texas.
There you go.
So getting in my correction.
And hey, one little FYI regarding the iPad 2 drawings. Legally, you don't have to make a contribution to enter the drawing, but you know, you'll be on the web where you can read the information about the drawing. You can just make a quick, easy, affordable contribution there. $35, $60, maybe $120. It all counts. It all adds up. It all makes KERA a success.
We are waiting to hear from you online at kera.org. You can do this with a credit card or you can set up a sustaining membership. You can also get to us by phone at 1-888-694-6931. Thank you so much.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's Master of Liberal Studies, an evening graduate program that allows you the intellectual freedom to design your own master's degree. You can learn more at smu.edu/MLS.
Yeah. You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is Anatol Lieben. He is professor of international relations and terrorism studies at King's College in London, also a senior fellow at the New America Foundation. His new book is called Pakistan, A Hard Country. If you'd like to join the conversation, we have lines open now at 1-800-933-5372. You can also send email to think@kera.org. Anatol, how is the Pakistani military organized?
The Pakistani military is pretty well organized by Pakistani or developing world standards. Now, you could say that's because the military extracts a huge proportion of whatever limited revenues the state manages to collect from Pakistani society. So, you know, some of the resources of 200 million people are being transferred to 500,000. But it's not just that. I mean, they don't, it's not a kleptocratic military like some in Africa. They don't simply steal the stuff and transfer it to bank accounts in Switzerland or in London or New York. The military spends money on itself in an orderly way. And that also provides services not just for the officers, but also to a limited extent for the rank and file as well. And that, along with this ethos of discipline, pride, loyalty, is what keeps the army united and wards off the threat of mutiny in its ranks. You could say, or at least I said in the book, that the Pakistani military is the only modern institution in Pakistan which actually works more or less as it's meant to, because democracy certainly doesn't, government doesn't, institutions don't. The problem is, of course, that that means that every now and again the Pakistani army does what it's not meant to, which is it overthrows the civilian government and takes power itself. It does so with the promise to clean up the government, to develop the country. But at least since the regime of General Ayub Khan in the 1960s, in fact, Pakistani military governments haven't managed to do that either. Pakistani military government, when it comes down to it, isn't much better in these ways than civilian government. And the reason is that the generals always end up, they have to end up ruling through the same political bosses, the same landowners, the same chieftains. So, of course, they end up ruling in the same way.
Well, if there is one significant comfort from the strength of the Pakistani military that is larger than the others, it is the fact that they seem to have very good control over the country's stockpile of nuclear weapons.
That's true. I don't share the widespread fears about Pakistan's nuclear weapons. As long as the army and the state survive, there's no way that they will fall into the hands of terrorists. There are two obvious problems, though. The first is, what happens if the state collapses and the army breaks up? Then, of course, nothing can be guaranteed. The second problem is, and here I think, you know, this is what the US, in my view, should be concentrating on, it's the safety of Pakistan's civilian nuclear energy sector and the nuclear materials there, because that is much less well protected. That wouldn't provide the materials for a nuclear bomb, but it could for a radioactive bomb, and that in itself would be a very severe threat, of course.
If anything could cause a split in the unity of the Pakistani military, what is it?
Well, in my view, and I know this is controversial, the biggest threat is some action by the United States against Pakistan, which many people in the army would feel in honor bound to resist. U.S. troops coming in on the ground into the tribal areas to seek out the Afghan Taliban and al-Qaeda, an extension of American drone raids much deeper into Pakistan, because that would create a direct tension between the good sense of the military, if you like, when it comes to not directly confronting America, and the feelings of honor of ordinary Pakistani soldiers. Now, I very well understand that given Pakistan's shelter to the top leadership of the Afghan Taliban, and given the inability of the Pakistan leadership to hunt down all of the top leadership of al-Qaeda, they have hunted down a good many, it must be said. I mean, I understand why Americans, and especially American soldiers, are so very angry at Pakistan. But, I mean, you know, I, I hope that some wise elements will also realize that the threats to America from any such action would probably vastly outweigh any short-term benefits.
So Pakistan has at least tolerated, if not welcomed, U.S. military operations there against the Taliban. But then in January of this year, you had a contract spy for the United States named Raymond Davis, who apparently killed three Pakistanis. And that that incident has been seen as a real turning point with regard to the Pakistani military's attitude toward the United States. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Well, yes. I mean, I was in Pakistan when Raymond Davis was eventually released. I hope that it won't be a turning point, because the Pakistani military both have given great help to U.S. intelligence in preventing terrorist attacks on the U.S., and also know very well that they really need to go on giving that help, because if, God forbid, there were a terrorist attack on the U.S., a successful one, I mean, the consequences for Pakistan from the U.S. Response could be absolutely catastrophic. So I hope that the cooperation will go on. But certainly the Raymond Davis case infuriated the Pakistanis. And, you know, with some reason, they were essentially forced by the U.S. to admit, or at least to give visas to, it's not clear how many have turned up, hundreds of American officials who the Pakistanis certainly suspect of being agents. And I did warn in my book, which was written long before the Raymond Davis case came out, that such agents in Pakistan would be hostages to fortune. Well, that's exactly what Raymond Davis turned out to be. Mm. And, of course, no country could possibly welcome having armed agents of another country wandering around getting into this kind of trouble. You know, if this happens again, God knows what the consequences would be. And I do have to say that people I know, both in the U.S. Foreign Service and in British intelligence, were quite horrified by the whole business, especially because it seems that Davis was not, in fact, a trained CIA agent, you know, carefully trained in intelligence work. He was a former Special Forces operative. And, you know, as we know from a number of incidents in Iraq and Afghanistan over the years, these people can be both extremely trigger-happy and not adequately trained for the countries in which they find themselves. I really don't think that this is a good idea from America's point of view, let alone Pakistan's.
So the Pakistani military now has asked the United States to remove some of its covert agents from the country and to curb the number of drone strikes. Does the military in Pakistan have the authority to do anything about those requests if they're not followed?
Well, it certainly has the ability to remove agents. Mm-hmm. It can arrest them. That would, of course, be a terribly bad idea from the point of view of U.S.-Pakistani relations, but it does have that power. When it comes to drone strikes, well, yes, it could order the Pakistani Air Force to shoot down. That would also be very bad for U.S.-Pakistani relations. Now, the Pakistanis have never done that so far. One reason is that they are a bit, well, actually more than a bit, hypocritical on the subject of the drone. Because as we know from Wikipedia, Pakistani officials and even the Pakistani military have actually welcomed some of the drone strikes because they've been killing Pakistani Taliban leaders, including some of the top leaders. The problem is, of course, that they're also killing a lot of Pakistani civilians in the tribal areas. And this has really angered many ordinary Pakistanis.
You know, Anatol, I'm really sorry. We're gonna hang up and call you right back. Your line has broken up, and we want to make sure that we can hear you. So we're gonna take a quick pause here. We will get Anatol Levin back on the telephone and hopefully clear up that line a little bit for you, so we can hear what's taking place. We're speaking this hour about his book, Pakistan, a Hard Country. It is available today as a thank you gift when you join us at the $120 membership level. You can do that by going right online to kera.org, click on that support button, and at that point, it is really easy for you to skim down and find the thank you gifts available at the $120 level. You can, of course, set up a sustaining membership, and that's just $10 a month. Or you can do it with your credit or debit card, and we will get that out to you quite soon. If you would like to join us on the phone, you can call 1-888-694-6931, and whoever answers should have the information that you need to make your contribution. Of course, contributions in any level are welcome. They are certainly helpful to us in being able to bring you the programs that you count on this station on a daily basis. We have you back now, Anatole.
Yes, hello.
Thank you very much. I apologize for the technical glitch there.
Sure.
Let's talk a little bit about this. There is, of course, the concern about U.S. activity and how it's presented and portrayed for the Pakistani people. How worrisome is, I don't know if obsession is too strong a word, but the great preoccupation that the Pakistani military has with India?
It's a terrible problem. Obsession is not too strong a word. Now, you can understand that from some points of view, both because of the long history of conflict with India, but also because India is so much enormously bigger and now spends 8 times as much as Pakistan on its military. But it does, and India has also got up to some nasty things against Pakistan in the past, as well as Pakistan, of course, getting up to some very nasty things against India in terms of terrorism or backing terrorism. But this Pakistani obsession with India is highly negative, nonetheless. It's partly responsible for the Pakistani military's shelter to the top Afghan Taliban leadership, because they see a danger after the American withdrawal of India backing anti-Pakistani forces in Afghanistan. And so the Pakistanis feel that they have to have some kind of allies, even though they recognize that the Afghan Taliban are extremely unsatisfactory allies. In addition, over the years, the Pakistani military have built up very close ties to some anti-Indian militant groups. And in the process, they have helped them to create such deep roots in Pakistani society that it's now impossible to get rid of most of them. So there is an uneasy truce between these groups and the Pakistani military. But there are terms to this. At the moment, they are preventing them from carrying out more attacks on India. And above all, they are preventing them from attacking the United States, at least touch wood. For me, that's the absolutely essential condition of the Pakistani-American relationship. I would continue it from a U.S. point of view as long as the Pakistani military sincerely does its best to prevent terrorist attacks on the United States and, of course, Britain and other U.S. allies. If the Pakistani military no longer does that, then for me, and I think for the vast majority of Americans, all bets should be off.
My guest is Anatole Levin, professor of international relations and terrorism studies at King's College. He's also a senior fellow at the New America Foundation and author of the new book, Pakistan, A Hard Country. You can join us now by calling 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org. If you would like to read this book, Pakistan, A Hard Country by Anatole Levin, we do have it available today as a thank you gift at the $120 contribution level or above. You can receive your copy simply by making that contribution online at kera.org. Or if you prefer, you can certainly do this by phone at 1-888-694-6931. Your support of the station is what makes it possible for us to bring you guests like this. Every single day, we try to bring you the people in the world who understand what's taking place, who have very different perspectives on things. We never say, believe this guest or don't believe this guest. What we want to do is bring you the experts and let you make the decision for yourself about what they have to say. And we think that is all too rare and certainly valuable in the media today. Jeff Whittington, senior producer of Think and host of Anything You Ever Wanted to Know, is back. Hello, Jeff.
Hi, Chris. Hello to you. I want to thank Lee Kleiman and Lisa Umholtz in Dallas for supporting the station. Ryan and Shannon Rich in Fort Worth. We also heard from Marco Rodriguez in Flower Mound, Sharon Ellis, who joined the station from New York City, Don and Christopher Bird in Carrollton, Laura Whitelaw in Fort Worth, Loretta Pendon in Chico, Susie Blaylock in Hearst, Tyler Love in Dallas, and Claire Greenberg in Dallas. Those folks are the ones that are paying the bills for your public radio station, folks. You listen to the station every day, and it's the first day of the membership campaign. Our overall goal for this drive is $625,000, eminently achievable with your call to 888-694-6931 or with your contribution on the web at kera.org.
If you've never joined on the very first day before, if you'd like to wait, you should try it. First of all, because we have this fabulous drawing, each of the next 9 days, we will be giving away an iPad 2, which is the brand new one, and that's available when you enter the drawing just simply by going online to kera.org or by calling 1-888-694-6931. You call today, and your name stays in the drawing throughout the 9 days, so you've got a really good chance, or a better chance, I should say, if you get in on this early. You can make your contribution and perhaps win, like, the coolest new piece of technology there is out there.
Yeah, if you join today, you have 9 chances to win. If you join tomorrow, you have 8 chances to win, because that's how many drawings will be left. Of course, you know, legally, you don't have to contribute to the station to get in on the drawing, but we hope that you will consider making an affordable gift of support to KERA. Because you listen to the station, you get something out of it. Fascinating conversation today with Anatol Levin on Pakistan, a country that is a pivotal country in the war on terror and in international relations, and what's going to happen in the East and in the Middle East and around the world. It's a great conversation today. I hope you're enjoying it. Please show the station that you appreciate this kind of conversation by going to kera.org and making a safe and secure contribution online. If you're already listening online, you're already there. So it's really easy for you to do.
That's right. We should talk to you podcast folks, because you might not be listening. Today is Monday. You might not be listening on a Monday. You might be listening on a Wednesday at midnight. Well, the phone number, 1-888-694-6931, is always available for you to make a contribution. And, of course, you can always go online to kera.org and make a contribution. We know that we have listeners to the podcast from far-flung corners of the United States and, in fact, the globe. We would love a gift of support from you if you are in a position to do so. Any amount is really appreciated, and we would ask you to value the amount of things that you learn and the great time that you spend listening to Think.
888-694-6931 is the toll-free number. Do it online at kera.org, but please do it today. Do your part now, 888-694-6931 or via the web at kera.org.
We'll be back in just a minute with Anatol Levin speaking about his book, Pakistan, A Hard Country. Again, that book is available as a thank you gift with a contribution of $120 or more. Thanks.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's Master of Liberal Studies, an evening graduate program that allows you the intellectual freedom to design your own master's degree. You can learn more at smu.edu/MLS.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is Anatol Levin. He is a professor of international relations and terrorism studies at King's College in London, also a senior fellow at the New America Foundation, and author of the new book, Pakistan, A Hard Country. If you'd like to join the conversation, give us a call now at 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org. Anatol, what is the state of the Pakistani economy?
Pretty bad. They suffered particularly badly from the global economic recession, from their own mismanagement, and from the very severe floods last year. So from what was or at least seemed to be a very good growth rate of more than 7% between 2000 and 2007, they have now plunged very badly to 3-4% or so. And that's not very far above the rate of growth of population. There are some brighter spots. They passed a fairly tough interim budget while I was there last month, though only under intense pressure from the IMF, and it must be said by presidential decree, because they couldn't get it through Parliament. And parts of agriculture are doing very well as a result of the global commodities boom, and that's helping to prop up parts of the rest of the economy. But no, I mean, it's a bad condition, and inflation especially is a real threat, and that, of course, goes straight into helping to cause public discontent and anger as well.
And you see global water, national water rights as an issue on the horizon as well.
Yes, I mean, it's already well over the horizon in some areas. And for me, in the longer term, that's to say in a few decades' time, it's water shortages, more even than extremism and terrorism, which is the greatest threat to Pakistan. By the middle of this century, according to the World Bank, they'll have around 335 million people in what is naturally an arid and semi-arid part of the world. Their water use is appallingly wasteful, and there are simply no more resources to draw upon. The water table is falling by tens of feet a year in many areas. And that, by the way, is before you factor in the hypothetical effects of climate change. So increased water shortages are not speculation. They're a certainty.
Given the power that tribal entities have, will they have to take this on in order to ensure the stability of the country moving forward?
Well, yes. Society itself will have to take responsibility for this. And the best hope is, as far as use of water is concerned, that as shortages grow, ordinary people will realize that they simply must be less wasteful in their use of water. The problem is that to teach people how to be less wasteful will require a major state effort, and it'll also require an improvement of what is one of the worst sides of the entire Pakistani system, its lack of education. So a great deal will need to be done, and the question is whether the will is there, not just in the state, but in the population as a whole.
Is the education problem mostly financial? Is it cultural? Where are the seeds of that?
Well, it starts with there not being enough resources in the first place. You know, the inability to raise taxes, the fact that so much of what you do raise goes to the military. But it's worse than that. Local politicians, if you travel in the Pakistani villages, you so often are shown the site of a school where the money was paid but was stolen, no school was built, or a school which is being used as a house or as a cow shed by the local politician or his relatives. And so on. So corruption is a huge problem. But yes, culture is also a problem, especially as far as women's education are concerned. The rates of women education in Pakistan are the lowest in South Asia, low even by the standards of the Muslim world. And that, of course, has a knock-on effect in so many other areas, especially standards of health. It's well known from so much of the world that educated women are much better at bringing up healthy children, but also perhaps most importantly in the birth rate. The other thing that we know very well is that women's education brings down the birth rate, and if that's not happening in Pakistan, one of the reasons is that the girls are not being educated.
Let's go to the phones now, and we'll take a call from Amjad in Dallas. Hi, Amjad.
Hey, how are you?
Great, thank you.
I have a question if you ask me. You have a very deep insight from the Pakistanis, and I'm belong to Pakistan. Now I'm settled here. Just want to know that, both countries are spending heavily on the defense, and there's no accountability after that. Is it not possible if some international powers, players like China, America, and then UK, they, along with them, kind of no war pact, or at least they can decrease their defense budget and spend some on their welfare of the people? There's too much hunger, poverty over there. Is it not possible part of the deal?
Well, it certainly should happen. I very strongly believe in encouraging forms of agreed arms control between India and Pakistan, and most importantly of all, some kind of START agreement on limiting nuclear weapons between India and Pakistan. Part of the problem is, of course, intense mutual distrust, just like between America and the Soviet Union. during the Cold War. But America and the Soviet Union, to some extent, proved they could overcome that. A bigger problem, it seems to me, is that India is looking not just at Pakistan, but also at China. India is competing with China as well as Pakistan. And it's very difficult to see how one could put in an effective arms control regime that would take in India as well as Pakistan, China as well as India and Pakistan. But perhaps in some limited areas something may be done, or perhaps one could get an agreement that would limit certain kinds of weapons, because after all, Indian tanks can't be used against China. You can't get a tank up the Himalaya Mountains. Tanks are obviously for use against Pakistan. If one could limit that kind of weapon. But for that, you also need to build trust, of course. And it goes without saying, Pakistan has to do its utmost to prevent further terrorism against India based in Pakistan.
We have time for one more call, and we'll go to Shannon in Arlington. Hi, Shannon.
Hi, thank you. I was wondering, with all the problems that Pakistan has in terms of military and confrontation with India, poverty, where does this idea of confrontation between the Sunni and the Shia comes? What triggers that part? And I don't understand. How can they afford within... Hello?
Yes, hi. Yes, go right ahead.
Yeah, go ahead. I guess this is my question.
Well, unfortunately, there is a history of hatred between the Sunni and the Shia, which came up very much in the 1980s after the Iranian Revolution. And some of the nastiest terrorist groups in Pakistan, who are now attacking the Pakistani state and are also plotting against us, they actually began as anti-Shia terrorist groups. I'm thinking of Lashkar-e-Jhangvi in particular. And they've also been targeting Christians within Pakistan. Now, the only good thing about this is that the Pakistani state, or at least parts of it, are willing to crack down on them. So they don't, and they also have much more limited sympathy in society than the groups which are threatening India. So with any luck, even if these groups can't be finished off, they can at least be contained and cut down a bit.
Anatol, with regard to the activity of the U.S. and its allies in the region, what are the biggest ongoing threats to Pakistani stability?
Well, the biggest threat, which I think must be obvious if you just look at what's happened since 9/11, is the war in Afghanistan. Mm. It is the war in Afghanistan, the Afghan Taliban coming over, the sympathy of people in Pakistan, especially in the Pashtun and tribal areas, for their co-ethnics, their fellow Pashtuns in Afghanistan. I mean, it's this more than anything else which has contributed to radicalizing parts of Pakistani society and increasing the threat to Pakistan. I know that that's not nice for the West to hear, but you have to understand the Pakistani resentment of this. I mean, for me, having traveled a lot in Afghanistan in the past, including in areas of which are now controlled by the Taliban, I'm very dubious, I have to say, about our chances of getting what we want in Afghanistan by military action, at least without a U.S. Military campaign in Afghanistan that would have to last for decades. I would advocate exploring, at least, the possibility of using Pakistan to mediate with the Afghan Taliban in the hope of getting an Afghan peace settlement. Now, I'm not sure that will happen, but I think it's worth trying when compared to the alternatives.
Anatol Levin is a senior fellow at the New America Foundation and professor of international relations and terrorism studies at King's College in London. His new book is called Pakistan, a Hard Country. Anatol, it's been a really informative hour. I so appreciate your time.
Thank you very much for asking me.
My name is Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening. Thanks to all of you who are online right now making contributions at KERA.org. We also have some of you calling in to make your pledges at 1-888-694-6931. We call them pledges for the most part these days. Most of you are using, credit cards and debit cards, which is great for us because we're able to put your money to work right away. But we are also able to offer you, if it's easier for you financially or if you just prefer to budget this way, this thing called the sustaining membership, which is where you decide, instead of saying, I'm going to give $360 a year to KERA, they just break it up so that every month $30 comes out of whatever checking account that you deem appropriate. We can take care of all of that for you when you go online to KERA.org or when you call us at 1-888-694-6931. Hey, Jeff.
Hey, Chris. Don't forget you can get your very own copy of Anatole Levin's book, Pakistan, A Hard Country. We were really thrilled to get him on the show today. He was actually in the States last week. He's back in London today. He just got back from Pakistan a couple of weeks ago, where he was there, sort of updating what he had researched for the book. So we're really lucky to get him, and really fortunate to be able to get him. Of course, being able to get him on the show to have this conversation comes with a cost. I mean, we've got to pay the phone bill. We have to keep the computers running. We have to keep the equipment running so that we can connect with him via phone, where he is in this case in London for the hour-long interview. All that comes with a cost, and we're asking you today to help offset that cost with a contribution.
You can do that at KERA.org or at 1-888-694-6931. Your contribution to KERA is really an investment in your personal education and your understanding about the world around you. I can't think of anything that is more worthy, after sort of food and shelter. Spending money on your brain is a wonderful thing, and it's good not only for you, but for the entire community. Rochelle Wynn in Dayton, Ohio, recognizes this. Thank you so much, Rochelle. Mary Hammer in Plano, thanks so much to Jeremy Pye in Dallas and Amand Brown in Dallas. Your contributions keep this station going. If we're sort of the heartbeat, you guys are the blood that runs through the body of North Texas and makes this all work. That's maybe a really messed up metaphor. I don't know. We do have copies of Anatole Levin's book, Pakistan, A Hard Country. If you are interested in international relations, if you have thought about Pakistan and are fascinated, but it feels like so much to take in, this book is really a wonderful a primer on what's taking place, what has happened up to this point, and what is likely, at least in Anatole's opinion, to take place in the future under a variety of different scenarios.
We are thrilled to have been able to bring you this conversation today, and are thrilled to be able to offer you your copy of the book Pakistan by Anatole Levin for a $120 contribution today. Just call 888-694-6931 or go online to KERA.org and make a contribution of whatever is right for you. If our basic membership level, $35, is right, if everybody who listened to KERA during the week just made a $35 contribution, the drive would end immediately. And as a matter of fact, we'd probably be able to start looking at future drives that are planned and say, well, since everybody who listened, all about 400,000 of you who sample the station for at least a few minutes every week, who use the station, who get something out of the station, because everyone's done their part, it makes it so much easier for everybody, and it makes it so much easier on you because we don't have to take as many days as is necessary to reach these membership goals. This is the first day, and there's lots of energy. The coffee's fresh down the hall. We're really excited to be able to offer you this opportunity to support your public radio station. But for it to close that circle, you have to actually give your support to the station. It's really easy to do. You just call 1-888-694-6931 or contribute safely and securely with your credit card or debit card online at KERA.org.
You can also, of course, give us a call at 1-888-694-6931. When you get in touch with us today, either at KERA.org or at that phone number I just gave you, your name will be entered into this drawing we have, these drawings we have for iPad 2s. Every day for the next 9 days, you will have a chance to win. And once you enter, your name stays in that drawing, unless, of course, you get pulled out. And that would be great for you, and we certainly wish you luck. So, making a contribution earlier rather than later is a really good thing for you. And, of course, it's good for us because we're able to simply get the money and move on and take care of business and provide you with the programming that you love.
Legally, you don't have to make a contribution to the station to enter the drawing, but, you listen. You should do your part. When you support KERA, you're also supporting 100.1 K261 CW in Tyler, 88.3 K202 DR in Wichita Falls, and 99.3 K257 EV in Sherman. This is 90.1 KERA Dallas, Fort Worth, Denton. And this is The Think Show, and this is your chance to support it. 888-694-6931. or contribute at KERA.org.
I love the producer in your soul that always has to give that disclaimer just to make sure that we make sure that everybody knows kind of what the rules are and everything.
Oh, great. Well, the producer down the hall put the prompt up there, so that's
required. Takes a little village here, but yeah, no, it's good to know. And of course, we would love for you to make a contribution, but yep, it is not legally required or required by the rules of the drawing. We would love to hear from you right now at KERA.org. Your contribution makes a big difference to this station. You know, you might be at a place where you can easily dash off a check or send in a credit card payment for a friend's membership of $1,500, or maybe you can swing a day sponsorship of $365, or maybe for you, $5 or $10 a month is what you can do this year, and all of it adds up and makes it possible for us to provide you with this programming that you rely on every single day of the year. We're always here for you. We ask you to be here for us. 3 times a year we come to you and ask you to make a contribution. The bare minimum we ask is that you make a contribution once a year. You can do this right now by going online to KERA.org, click on that support button, which is prominently featured on our homepage, or make a quick call to 1-888-694-6931. Thanks.
The Think production team includes engineer Nilofer Arsala. Our senior producer is Jeff Whittington. Learn more about today's show, find out about upcoming programs, and download our free daily podcasts at kera.org/think. And we'd like to hear what you think about Think. Email your comments, questions, and suggestions to think@kera.org.